So we're in Ephesians chapter 5. I was trying to remember that today. I was like, we weren't here last week, right? We weren't. So that's had a couple of snow breaks there. Hopefully that won't be the case anymore this year, but we'll see. But as we're continuing, we are looking, of course, at Paul's epistles. In specific, have been looking at the book of Ephesians. Really enjoyed this study. I've gotten a lot out of it, and as we've went through each chapter, we're looking at what was the Ephesian church dealing with, and how can we learn from that as we went through each of these chapters. I won't belabor the points there, but last time we were together, we were looking at the first part of chapter 5. Come on now. There you go. So let's go to Ephesians 5 and verse number 21. His kind of transitional verse here. This is a place where if I were breaking the chapters, I'm not. I don't have that ability. But if I were to do it, I would have broken the chapter here and went on into chapter 6 before I had another chapter break. Because really, what we're going to talk about over the next several verses and paragraphs is on relationships. And this key word, submission. We talked about that term before, but to submit, do you remember what that term means? What's the illustration there? To put oneself under, right? And so in verse 21, he says, submitting to one another. So the idea there is we're to put ourselves under each other. And as he gets into the rest of the chapter, he's going to talk about some of the ways we do that, some of the expectations. as we're moving forward. But we're talking about this key term, and again, it's literally the idea of putting oneself under the control of someone else. We're going to look at a couple different relationships. Let's see if we can get them. Who are we looking at? So the glaring one next is what? Husbands and wives, right? And the key element there of their relationship and how submission plays a role. What are the other relationships where we see submission playing a part?
Children and parents.
Servants and masters. Okay, bond servants and their masters. Right? Don't forget, there's another one in there that you might miss.
Christ in the church.
Christ in the church, right? And so we're going to come back to that. So in these verses, in chapter 5, 22 through 33, he is keying on two different kinds of relationships. He's keying in on husbands and wives, and then also on Christ in the church. And so as we read this, that's kind of what jumps out. So what I would like to do is read 22 to 33 and then come back and kind of break it down. So let's begin at verse 22. It says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and it is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle, or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, And I am saying that it refers to Christ in the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. All right, there's a lot here, and I'll admit to you, it's kind of, I'm trying to go through it in a logical way, and this is one of those texts where there's so much here, I know I'm going to miss something. I'm going to do my best to cover, as God would have us, the text. So, as he's going through, he's talking to first who?
To husbands.
No.
To
wives.
Right.
To wives, and who else? It's not just wives. Who's the other group that he's talking to? The church. Right? And he's paralleling them. I've mentioned this several times. Jody was talking about it on Sunday. But the Bible is filled with shadows or types. And there's a comparison being made here. The first one is between the wife's relationship to her husband, and the other one is the church relationship to Christ. And so those are, he's kind of going through and he's saying, look at how they parallel one another. And as you get to the end, verse 32, I'm going to start at the end sort of. He says, this mystery is what? Profound. That's the English Standard. And I am and I'm saying that this refers to Christ and the church. So in talking about this, what is he truly trying to explain?
Church and Christ relationship.
Absolutely. He's using the husband-wife relationship to really speak about the relationship the church has to Jesus. So I just want to keep that kind of at the forefront of our thinking. So let's go back to verse 22. He says, wives, submit to your own husband. Same word that's used in the previous verse. And so essentially, literally, what is he saying to the wife? Put yourself under the control of your husband. All right? And he's going to say something very similar to the church when he says later, verse 24, now as the church submits to Christ. So what is he saying to the church? Put yourselves under the control of Jesus. In the book of Ephesians, he's already mentioned this, but who's the head of the church? Christ, right? And let me just get through all this and I'll take some questions. So as you're looking at both of those, the wife is to what? Submit or put herself under the control of her husband in everything, huh? Well, I'm going to come back to that. So I want to get in something that some people get tricked up in here and kind of explaining that. All right. So so the wife is to be submissive to her husband. And so what does that mean? All right. So I can't just look at this text. We're going to have to pull in some other text as we move along. So he's later going to make a quotation from the book of Genesis in verse 31. Talking about how a husband and a wife are bonded together. That comes from Genesis, of course. If we go back there, let's go to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. Of course, in chapter 1, if we back up there, he introduces the idea of the creation of man and woman. But it's in chapter 2 that he gets into a deeper discussion of the relationship between a husband and his wife. You go through the first part of the chapter, he's talking about some other things, but you get to verse 18. Let's look at these verses. I won't read all of them, but I want to note some things. Number one, he notes, what about man? At this time, Eve is not being created, right? And so what does he say about man? He's alone, and it's not good that he's alone. It's interesting, he uses that term good because he's used it in chapter 1 and into chapter 2 to say what? He's used it in a positive way, right? Each day of creation, it was good, it was good, it was good. And he gets to day 7, the end of day 6, and he said it was very good, All right, and so all of those times it's used in a positive sense, but in this verse he uses it in a negative sense. It is not good that man should be alone. And so that's the impetus for the creation of woman. So she's created with that intention in mind to bring what? Companionship. The newer translations do a little better job with this translation when it talks about, I will make what? A helper fit for him. Now, the older translation might have the word help meet, but the idea there's someone who can walk alongside him. And so that's what he says. He's going to make a helper. You read the text. I won't read all of this, but of course he causes the man go into deep sleep. He takes the rib out, and he creates woman. Why is she given the name woman? Because she was taken out of man. Again, that close union between the human beings, right? Between man. Between a husband and his wife. There's a physical closeness between them. Then you have in verse 23 the response of the man to the woman. How does he respond? Verse 23. This is at last. Why does he say that? Well, he's looked at all the animals. He didn't find a helper fit for him, right? He says, here at last, after all of that, is what? Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Again, a reference to what? A deep connection between a husband and a wife. She shall be called woman. Why? Because she was taken out of man. And again, she's given that name, again, because of that close union. Verse 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. And so as you see this picture in Eden, with the creation of husband and wife, you have two people, what? Walking alongside each other. Now, we continue on. We know what happens in chapter 3. I'm sorry, I'm going to have a lot to get to, Jody. I'll come back. I will come back and give you a chance to ask questions. But I want to connect all of this. So we go through chapter 3. The serpent tempts Eve, she sins, and then Adam alongside of her. And then God lays out the consequences of their actions. Now, he'd already promised them what? What would happen if they did this? They would die, right? That process would begin, and there would be big changes as a result of it. And that's what comes. Now, let's go to the woman, because it's to the woman he talks about the change in relationship between the husband and the wife. It's changed. It's different. He says, chapter 3, verse 16, I will surely multiply your pain and childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. And then I want you to notice for the second half of that. Your desire shall be contrary to your husband, but he shall rule over you. What is that? What is he seemingly indicating? And I'll give you a chance to respond. What's he indicating by saying you shall be... Your desire should be contrary to your husband, but he shall rule over you.
What she wants is not going to be in line with what her husband wants. But he's going to rule over you.
Okay.
Right? Contrary means against.
Mm-hmm. In conflict, right? That's the idea. There's conflict is now going to arise between the husband and the wife. the power dynamic is changed in the relationship. The man now has a position of ruling, whereas the wife has been made in subjection to the husband. Do you have some? Yeah. So I've done some research into that, and I believe, and you do your own research, but I believe the contrary is the right interpretation or translation, I should say, translation of that Hebrewic language there. That it really is the idea of contrary, conflict. Yeah, I think your desire shall be contrary to your husband.
Yeah. When society proved it, look at the marriages nowadays. Mm-hmm.
And so so he's noting that conflict is going to grow between a husband and a wife. And part of that's going to happen why? And this is the way I understand it. You can think about it. Some of us have siblings, don't we? And I don't know where you fall in the line of siblings, but what typically happens among siblings? Who normally has the greater power in those relationships? The older, right? Well, this is general. This is general. So for my example,
my oldest brother, we'll give him the credit.
Yeah. So I know in my house, when I grew up, my older brother was bigger. He was 3 years older. He was often given more responsibility than I was. Did I like that? I didn't like it. We fought. And a lot of that conflict arose out of the dynamic in our relationship. Because of that power dynamic, what did I do? I fought against it. And at times, in my opinion, he lorded it over, right? At least the opinion of the childhood me. And that caused trouble. And so introduced the possibility for conflict. And so I think what he's saying here now with this, the way the relationship, the role in the relationship, is going to introduce opportunities for conflict. So what do you do in a relationship when one person has the mindset to go one way, the other one has the mindset to go a different way? You got to make that decision, don't you? And at times, when that decision's made, the one who doesn't get their way, what happens?
They don't like it.
And that can cause conflict to arise. And so this idea is introduced here. I think that's goes a little too far. This is, again, you go and you research it. You study the Hebrew and see what you think. My understanding is that probably is too far with what it's saying. I think it's more about it introduces the possibility for conflict. Again, please do your own research. Don't take my word for it. But that's my understanding of the text. And I think when we get to the New Testament, that same idea is kind of presented. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 2. Now, I know in the context, before anybody says it, I know it's more about the relationship within the church and the roles of men and women in the church. But at the core of this, though, is the relationship between a man and a woman and how those dynamics are established. So, if you go to 1 Timothy 2:8, he brings up the idea of a prayer and that men should be praying everywhere. And then in verse 9, he changes his focus onto who? The woman, right? And he says that she should do what? She should adorn herself with modesty, respectable apparel is the ideal there. Let's see. Verse 11, he says, let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. Again, what is that? That voluntary act of putting yourself under the control of someone else, right? That they should learn quietly or in submission. And then he goes so far to say, I do not permit or allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. So he reintroduces that idea of submission, quiet submission. And that's going to cause conflicts in churches, isn't it, at times? Or has at least the possibility to cause conflict. Because maybe the elders of a congregation or the men choose to go one direction. You think it should have been a different one. What are you going to do with that? Is it going to become conflict for you? Or is it going... Or is it the idea of submitting? So verse 13. So this is what I want to get into, the discussion between husband and wife. So he goes back to the relationship of Adam and Eve in his reasoning behind this. He says, for Adam was formed first, then Eve. So what's the first reason for the relationship of roles in the church? It's the created order, right? Adam was created first, then Eve. So there's that. Then verse 14, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. The second thing was, has to relate back to the sin that was committed in the garden. That Eve taking the leading role of being deceived, she then is part of her consequence is, again, going back to Genesis chapter 3, is this submissive role in the relationship between men and women. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. And so, again, that characteristic of that relationship, he's relating back to the created order. Yeah, Joey.
The first thing I was going to mention before is the fact that at the beginning of Ephesians, it says submitting yourselves. The submission is not forced by the party. It is voluntarily surrendered by the person submitting. So the emphasis is not that the man needs to be ruling over his wife by force, but she should be willingly submitting herself to him.
Well, and any submission that's forced is not truly submission. That's lording, right? That's exercising dictatorship, and that's not the pattern, right? It is a voluntary thing, a willingness to put oneself under the control of another.
It's also interesting to me that it says that she'll be called a woman because she's taken out of man, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But do you realize that every other man ever born is taken out of woman?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah.
It don't mean anything, but it's...
It's interesting, right? But again, what did he say? She shall be saved in... And I think the ideal there in 1 Timothy 2, she shall be saved in childbearing, has somewhat of a general rule about the woman's role in the home, of when the children are young, of setting those foundational keys, of being an active part in that. But the other part is the role she played in doing what? Not only did she give birth to sin, but now she has a chance to give birth to the Redeemer of sin. So it wasn't through man. Man had no part to play in the incarnation of God, of Jesus. It was woman who had the opportunity to bring that about. God purposely removed man from that.
Another point I think is important is that when God looks at this scenario of sin, he says, man, by man, sin entered into the world. So even though Eve committed the sin, clearly God placed that responsibility upon Adam because as the man, he should have been protecting his wife and leading her in the path would help her overcome.
Yeah, and so somewhat of his responsibility now to be the spiritual head of the home has to relate, and we'll get into man's responsibility in a minute, but it comes out of almost, it's a punishment for his lack of leadership in the garden. Because if you go back to 1 Timothy 2, who was deceived? the woman. The indication there, the implication is what? He wasn't. He'd sinned without even being deceived. He knew what he was doing. So he had no kind of excuse, even though it wasn't reasonable. But he didn't even have the excuse of, I didn't understand. Or I didn't know. He willfully committed that. So, a lot there. Yes, ma'am.
So why does it say that women will be saved through childbearing? Is it because of when we're younger, we're more likely to not have patience and more deceived by things? And then when we get older and we have children, then our patience grows? Or is it saying that because Mary had Jesus and Jesus was the ultimate Savior?
Great question. And so let's go back to 1 Timothy 2. I'm glad you asked it. So she shall be saved through childbearing if they, who's they? The children, right? In faith and love and holiness with self-control, those Christian attributes. So what is he saying? Well, ultimately, what is the key role of any mother? We'll get later into the key roles of a father.
So that pronoun they is not referring to the husband and wife, but the children's one?
I would think that's the children. I'll have to think more about it, but my intuition is that's the children, if they. Because childbearing is what's under consideration, not the husband and wife necessarily there. And this is the reason why I say that is, what is the essential role of a mother? Is it to go out and to make money? No, I mean, women can do that, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Is it to tidy a house? Do that, a lot of women do, and work hard and diligent at that. But that's not the key role of a woman, of a mother, is it? What's the key role of a mother? It is in their children, right? And instilling in them the values of their Christian faith. And so it's in fulfilling that role. Now, their role the father plays as well. We'll get into that in just a minute. But that's kind of relates back to that key. And so I think it gets back to purpose, right? Where do women find their purpose? I want to go to kind of connect this. Go to 1 Peter chapter 3. And we're going to come back and cover this in a minute, all the rest of it. But I wanted to go to 1 Peter 3, 4 first. Let's start at verse 3. All right, talking about the wife here. He says, 1 Peter 3, 3. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, the putting on of gold, jewelry, or the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves by submitting to their own husbands. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Now the frightening, I'll go ahead and just mention this real quickly. I think that's talking about abusive husbands. That goes back to the husband who's trying to force his wife into submission through physical harm. So I'll just say that. But that's not the key here. What's the key? Well, it can be very tempting for people to make their life about the physical, right? About the way they look, about the way they dress, about what they wear, right? As far as jewelry goes. He says, that's a temptation. He says, but avoid it. He's not condemning wearing clean, nice clothes or even jewelry. But what he's saying is that cannot be the driver of your life. Look at the vanity we see online, on our screens, we hear about all the time with people, and it's like in Hollywood and other places, who become very vain. Vanity is a dangerous thing. Go read Ecclesiastes. A man who understood vanity because he had become very vain in his life, Solomon. Vanity is a trap. He says, don't become vain. Don't let it be external. But do what? Yes, it's an interior thing, right? It's about who you are inward and out. It can't be merely about the outward. And one of the things is by this willingness to submit to your husband. And he says that's a good thing. You're the children of Sarah if you can do that. You're like the holy women of old. Right? And
in your submission to God, you then submit yourself to your husband because that was the will of God.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's about the only way you can submit to your husband. If you do submit to God, I'm living proof.
So, all right, so let's go back to. Hold your place here in 1 Peter 3. I'm going to come right back to that. But let's go back to a point that was brought up earlier. So it says, verse 22, Ephesians 5:22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. All right? Now, as the church submits to Christ, verse 24, so wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Now, some have tried to say, well, this applies to Christian relationships. What about if you're living in a relationship, which is very common, where you have a Christian wife who's married to a non-Christian husband? Do the same rules apply?
Yes, brother.
Number one, I want you to note, it doesn't say in the Lord. It says as to the Lord. So the same way you submit to the Lord, so you must submit to your husband. But I'll give you even a clearer statement of this. If you go to back to 1 Peter chapter 3, what does verse 1 say? Well, let's read it. So verses 1 and 2. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some, what? Do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. When they see your respectful and pure conduct, do not let your adorning. And then he goes into what we were just talking about. So notice what kind of relationship is he talking about?
The husband is not a Christian.
Mm-hmm. And the wife is. Right? And so how is he saying that wife should react to her husband who's not a Christian?
Still be subject to him.
You still need to be submissive. You still need to put yourself under his control. Because again, what's being said in Genesis chapter 3 is not, there are no Christians around at that time. That's a general rule for all marriages to come afterward. That's going to be the relationship, not just of Adam and Eve, but that's the general practice there going forward. And so, so just as a Christian wife married to a Christian man should be submissive, so applies to a woman who's a Christian who has a husband that's not. And that's the very heart of what Peter's saying. He's saying what your ultimate goal should be is to win that person to the Lord. And part of the way you do that is by how you act toward them and what they see in you. Now, we'll come back to talk about the husband here. I'm not missing verse 7. I know it's there. So I want to deal with that. But I want to go back to Ephesians first about the husbands. But before I move on, anything about that? All right, let's go back to chapter 5. And I want to now look at the relationship of the husband and the wife. Oh, before I do that, when we talk about submission of wives to husband, again, what's the backdrop of that? Well, it's the relationship of the church to Christ. And so you should always ask, because he's relating those two things, and he's saying they're parallel with one another, how would you expect the church to submit to Jesus? He says in the same way a wife should submit to her husband. And so the husband is the head of the family, and so as we'll note later, he needs to be respected in that role. All right, let's go forward. Let's go to verse 25. I won't read all this, but we've already read it once. But let's look at a few things. Now, you'll notice, who does he spend more time on?
The husband.
The husband, doesn't he? He spends a lot more ink on the husband here. And he's going to, can you think, so with the wife's relationship to her husband, what's the word that sticks out?
Submission,
right? What's the word that sticks out when it comes to the husband's relationship to the wife?
Love.
And parallels that with Christ's relationship with the church. And it's so, the standard for a husband's love for his wife, what's the standard? The love Christ has for the church. All right, so me and you, when you look around and you ask, am I loving my wife the way I should? Don't compare yourself to another man in the congregation or in your community or at your work. Compare yourself to Jesus. And I'll say all of us men are failing that. We may be striving toward it. We're not there yet. But that's the word. What's interesting is, and we've noted this before, but in the Greek language, in the original language, the word love, there's several different words we translate love. We think about the word eros, which is where we get our word erotic. What I found interesting was, I've learned this recently, is that word's never used in the New Testament. You'll never see the eros used. Another term, and eros is that, it's,
romantic.
Well, it's not even romantic. It's
lust.
Yeah, it's more of a lustful kind of thing. Now, and you do see those concepts in the New Testament, but the word eros is never used. But the Greeks had that word.
Is it in like in Song of Solomon or anywhere
else? Well, that's Hebrew. Song of Solomon's Hebrew, not Greek. I don't know about the Greek words translated love as much. Good study. I haven't done it yet. But in the Greek, you have the word eros that could have been used. It never is, interestingly enough. A couple other words. The word sorge. Now, the word sorge is used a couple of times, both in a negative kind of context. But sorge is the word of a mother to a child. That's kind of the image that's being dealt with there. In the book of Romans, or in the letter of Romans, Paul uses that to condemn some of those who were living, saying they didn't even have the kind of love a mother should have for her children, right? So you see the word sorge, again, used just a couple of times, not used very much. You have another word that is used a lot more frequently, which is the word phileo, right? Which is where we get Philadelphia from. We've mentioned that before. What does that word relate to? Brotherly love. It's the kind of friendship love. But it also carries with it, interestingly enough, an emotional kind of deal behind it. What's the problem with emotional love?
It's fleeting.
It can be fleeting. That's exactly right, right? It can change with your emotions, right? And so that term is used some. You go to John, where you have the conversation between Peter and Jesus. When Jesus asked Peter three times, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Peter, every time he responds, uses the word phileo. Yes, Lord, I love you, right? But that's a friendship kind of love. It's deeper than the other ones, but it's still somewhat superficial because it's based on emotion. And then you have the word agapeo or pao, or as we would transliterate it, agape, right? That's a term that's used over and over again in this text. When it says, husbands, love your wives. Agapeo, your wife. That kind of love, that word carries the idea of devotion, right? It's a love that's devoted. It's not temporary based on emotional characteristics or context. It doesn't change because the situation changes. It's ongoing. It does not change. God loves us that way. Even if I'm out there sinning, I leave Christ, God still has love for me. Now, that doesn't mean he can overlook sin and he has to do, you know, there's certain things that he commands of me. But that's the kind of love. It's devoted to the other one's good, no matter the circumstances. And also, their interest is always for the other person's good or betterment. Yes, sir?
It's not dependent on another person, mm-hmm. what they do or don't do.
Absolutely.
Love is absolutely given
irrespective. Yeah. So it's not circumstantial in any way. It's constant. That may be a word that we think about there. I'm out of time. He actually gave me an extra minute there. Thank you. We have a lot more to say about the husband's relationship. And then we'll come back to Jesus and the church. Because, again, that's the underlining subheading here is the relationship between Jesus and the church. Thank you all. We'll look at that next week. Again, thank you all so much. We'll dismiss and come back for our devotional in just a couple of minutes. Thank you.